This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. I love having poets on the show, for one thing because I love their language, and for another because poets can make us see the world in a different way, sometimes more clearly, sometimes more complicatedly, as is true, I believe, of the poet Monica de la Torre, who is my guest today. Monica de la Torre's latest work is entitled Talk Shows. Monica de la Torre, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hi, Matt. It's great to be here.
Pleasure to have you. How'd you get interested in writing poetry?
I think poetry chose me. I know poets say this all the time. It's sort of a cliche, but it's really true. I have no idea what made me think that I could be a poet.
Were you one of these people who was writing poetry when you were 7 years old?
Yes. I was writing poetry when I was 5 years old, I believe. Yeah. And I would hide in a closet and write.
And did you keep journals all through or for a while? And do you still have some of those early poems?
I have the journals. I have some of the poems. But journal writing never interested me that much because I was too self-conscious.
But poetry?
Poetry did, yeah. I mean, it was weird because somehow I believe that people who write journals have the presumption that at some point someone will discover their journals. And poetry was like, poetry was more private than journal writing, which is weird.
It's just kind of like drawing pictures, maybe?
Yes, exactly. Venting, also.
Do you make your living as a poet?
No,
I don't. It's very hard for poets to make a living unless they're in the academy where a lot of poetry resides these days.
Right.
Is that a negative influence on poetry, do you think?
Quite frankly, I believe it is.
And why?
Because I think the academy is a very controlled environment, and I don't think poetry comes from there.
Where does poetry come from, then?
A life well-lived, and experiencing things that just, you know, experiencing things without a preconceived notion of what they're supposed to be, or where they're going, or why you're experiencing them. I think you just have to be open, and I think academia certainly plays a part, but I have a problem with the idea that you go to school to learn how to write poetry. Mm-hmm. I think poetry is not about learning how to be a poet. I mean, I remember Robert Creeley once said that in his family, his sister was the real poet. He was just like bouncing a ball. He wasn't writing poetry. He was just bouncing a ball.
So it's too confining in a way, you think, academic poetry?
Yes, although I must say, I am in academia myself. But I'm studying.
What do you teach?
Well, I'm studying a PhD in Spanish and Portuguese literature, and I'm writing my dissertation right now. And I also happen to teach.
What is the dissertation on?
My dissertation is on poetry groups of the 70s in Latin America. So it's poets that were very young in the 70s under dictatorships in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Peru. In Mexico, too, although in Mexico there was no dictatorship. And they're poets who want to be very political, but they're kind of tired of the preachy Neruda type of model. They're not self-righteous. They don't feel like they have the moral authority to tell people what to think. They don't think that they can speak for the people to a degree.
And so how do they get their political views out there in a non-didactic way?
So they're inspired by guerrilla tactics. So it's more like interventions in the public sphere. There's a lot of mimicking of official discourse and ventriloquism. They're just representing a polyphony that's very contradictory to many degrees, or to a large extent. But it's more mirroring language in the public sphere than telling people what they should be doing or thinking.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe your own poetry or poetic style?
Well, yeah, I guess they say that criticism is an exercise in autobiography. So, of course, I gravitated towards that topic because I believe in that. And my book is called Talk Shows for a reason. I really think that language in the public sphere says so much about everything. I mean, it's all right there.
The you have a poem entitled Talk Shows that really isn't about talk shows itself. It seems more like overheard conversations.
Exactly, right.
And then you do have a poem later on that has the expression talk shows in it, mm-hmm. where they are described as kind of day after day of oblivion or something like that.
Right, right.
Why did you use the title poem, talk shows, not really to talk about talk shows?
I think the title could be said in two different ways. One would be talk shows and talk shows. So we have both of those in the book. The poem, talk shows, is actually talk shows. And the talk shows in the other poem is alluding to that particular variety of spectacles.
One line in this book, Monica de la Torre, leapt out at me. It's called, I believe this is it, "True Poems Are Fires." Mm-hmm. Do you want to describe what you mean by that? True poems are fires.
Well, that poem actually was a procedural piece. What happened is that I was at a reading where Paul Hoover, a poet who's very well known in this area and in New York, read poems in Spanish. He has a book out called Poems in Spanish. And he doesn't speak Spanish. He doesn't read Spanish. But he imagined that he was a poet writing in Spanish and wrote these poems in English. So I was mystified by this process. And I spoke to him at the end of the reading. And I said, you know, I would love to translate your work into Spanish and then play with it and see what happens. And he was very nice. And he said, sure, go ahead. So then I translated the poems into Spanish. And I realized that what I could do in order to really make these be poems in Spanish was look at lines of real poets who wrote in Spanish that had something to do with the poems that Paul Hoover had written. So I went and looked, like I cut the lines in pieces, strips of paper, and I went and looked at my poetry collection and found lines that somehow had something to do with Paul Hoover's lines. So that particular line that you're talking about, "True Poems Are Fires," is taken from a poem by Neruda, Pablo Neruda. And I can tell you which one exactly. So it's very interesting because obviously Paul Hoover is very well read. And he, I'm sure, has read Neruda. So somehow that filtered into this poem. He didn't know that he was quoting him, but he might have been. I think, yeah, it's a poem called "Muchos Somos," We Are Many. That's what there, that, yeah, it comes from there. So what does it mean for me, "True Poems Are Fires"?
Or was because that obviously just part of the game?
Well, it was a game, but I think the poem actually makes a lot of sense. And that's fascinating to discover. Hmm. I didn't have a preconceived plan, but when it finally congealed, it was surprisingly coherent.
Did you think there's something weird about his effort to appropriate Spanish, though, or an English version of what he conceives Spanish to be?
Well, I don't think it was inappropriate. I just think that I was trying to discover whether there were any cliches and stereotypes that he was falling back on. And I think to a degree there were, but they were... You know, at this point, I don't even remember his poems. I remember my poems, but I don't remember his.
Well, I'd like to get to one of your poems. Why don't we start, anyway, with your opener, the script, if you
okay.
could read it for us, because
sure.
I think the listener will be able to get a feel for your art and your craft. You're listening to Monica de la Torre reading from her work of poetry entitled Talk Shows.
Very good. Just a few things before I read the poem. There's a reference to an early Christian saint. Her name is Comernus. She also has another name, which I've forgotten at this point. But she was about to be assaulted by barbarians, and she prayed to God and grew an impressively disgusting beard, which kept the barbarians away. And then she told the story and helped spread the word in Christianity. So I was very interested in the lives of saints. That's what I was reading at the time. But this poem is really not about that. Anyway, the script. It's divided in three parts. One, you thought this would be a dance lesson. Things were easier then. No marimbas, no clarinets, only a longing for the fun to begin. Rain came down. Nothing seems as remote as the days you didn't have to think about it. Always already there, gushing out. Control was required to stop ideas from overflowing. You did your job well. You killed them as one kills Easter baby chickens. Two. Rasputin was on the lookout. Magdalene had multipurpose hair. Comernus had it in stocks where and when she needed it. On her beard especially. Anything to keep the barbarians away will do. Chopped noses, rotten chicken stuffed in corsets. We were told that the demons would come out in Maine. They hate recollections and certainty. Their favorite verb is sabotage. 3. Rasputin helps one to recognize inspiration, but, oh, what could imagination be? To retrieve, to plunder, to forge, to be bored, to rip kites so they may stay on the ground, to forget jokes and misunderstand common sense, to sit for 4 hours without getting up, to count words and people and only remember their numbers, to listen closely to what loons could be trying to say, to permutate dots so that lines are never identical to each other, to return to known places and act always the same, thus the slightest change might become apparent, to force things to happen, to pretend there's meaning when all that comes out is a, my dog loves me and he's no showboat, to think there's nothing to say, to leap from canopy to can openers to can open her. You've begun. Now use your props.
That's Monica LaTorre reading her opening poem called The Script in a new book of poetry, Talk Shows. It's a fascinating poem. You have that wonderful play on words at the end. Mm-hmm. And there are plays on words and playfulness with language throughout this collection. How important is that to you, just to show the liveliness and the fun that you can have with the language, or the free association you talk about also, mm-hmm. Or in that poem you just read, you know, ideas are overflowing, mm-hmm. but also in a playful way. So the importance of hearing the play in the language, mm-hmm. how is that for you?
I think poetry first and foremost is about language, and I think language always means. So I'm not as concerned I'm not as concerned with what it is that I have to say and project out to the reader. I'm more concerned with what the language is doing, and that's just my take on poetry. And so in this poem, I think I'm kind of demystifying the creative process. I don't think you have to have an extraordinary life in order to have something to communicate. I don't really, unfortunately, believe in epiphanies. I mean, I think they do happen, but I don't think I have to have an epiphany in order to write a poem and then transmit it to the readers. I think what happens is once you're writing, I believe in the process of just, you know, writing is not fun often. It's kind of boring. You just sit in a room and see what you can come up with. And the magic starts coming when the language is doing something.
In the process. You know, we do a little clinic sometimes at the Progressive, with the Progressive Media Project, which sends out commentaries. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, don't wait for the muse. If you're waiting for the muse, you're never going to get anything done.
Exactly.
And to the extent that the muse strikes, phantom as it is, it strikes when you're working. Mm-hmm. Maybe when you're in the mm-hmm. shower.
Right.
But usually when you're, you know, in the middle of composition.
Yeah. The muse, and I think that the beginning of the poem is about that. Like, the muse always visits me at the wrong time. When I'm walking my dog, when I'm having a great time at a bar or at a party, and then she goes away, and then I'm by myself in my room trying to write.
Mm-hmm. As much as your poems are about language, there is some substantive meaning that comes through.
Of course.
And some of that is a feminist critique of our world. Mm-hmm. You've got a long poem on Amy Vanderbilt's clothes and her worship of fashion.
Right.
There's a couple things. A bride, this is a kind of a harrowing one, a bride who dies on her wedding day because she spends too much time at the sun tanning salon and is cooked to death.
Right.
There's a symbol for
that's
you.
That's an urban myth.
It's never happened?
Well, I'm sure it did happen, but it was an urban myth that I heard a number of times in Mexico City.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. I even heard it supposedly from people who had been invited to the wedding.
Well, maybe it actually happened then.
Well, I think it might have happened. Yes, absolutely. It might have happened.
And you also go after the myth of benign domesticity. Here's a couple of lines. Mm-hmm. Home is where the heart lies burning, an icon of past homes burning, mm-hmm. a red sacrifice. That's not usually the language Certainly, it's not the hallmark language of family life. Mm-hmm. What are you trying to get at here?
With those lines.
With those lines, or with the woman on her wedding day, or
right. Well, like Amy Vanderbilt, for instance. I found a guidebook at a used bookstore in Maine a few years ago, and I was just struck by her, by the certainty of her judgments, you know.
But that comes with class, or class privilege.
Of course. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it was so racist. I mean, there was a color chart, and what blonde should wear, what brunette should wear, what women with black hair, but there were no blacks and no Hispanics, no brown people, no. So, of course, that's really upsetting. And I took it, and what I did in that piece is I made her, at that time I was very interested in appropriation. So what I did is I turned every paragraph that, I basically took her language and put her as a character. So instead of her telling you what to do, she's the one who does all the things that she tells people to do. And in the end, she comes across as very ridiculous. I think that was my intention, to ridicule her. So that was my tiny little strategy to turn the tables, you know, at least discursively. Mm. And there's another poem in here that I had fun with, The Angel in the House, that I think gets to what you're saying. I'll read it because it's very short.
Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. It's in the section of the book called How To's. And the Amy Vanderbilt poem is in there too. Let's see. Here we go. The Angel in the House. A. Makes a thoughtful Christmas gift. Beware and handle with care. Boxes may damage the wings. And or B. Pluck all feathers out. Rinse with lukewarm water. Let boil until distinctive features vanish. Customize your angel. Dress it up. Draw its face, if it doesn't already have one. Or C. Dissect. Wire electric installment through the spinal cord. Hang it.
Yeah. That's Angel in the House, Monica De La Torre, reading from her latest work, Talk Shows, her first collection of her own poetry. You've done translation and other collaborations with artists, I understand. One poem here is a political poem. It's about Osama bin Laden, and it's called Soccer Dreams. Mm-hmm. I didn't catch slow me that it was about Osama bin Laden until I read the notes at the back, and then the poem took on a totally different meaning. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could introduce the poem and then read it.
Yes, but can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. What did you think it was about?
That's now you're getting cruel.
No, I'm very curious. Okay,
I hadn't figured it out.
I see. Well, this was a time when, and you might remember it, and they still actually do it. They never say Osama's name, right? So he was always the unmentionable one or whatever. Obviously, not to remind us that he's around somewhere and he's a real threat, right? So I was, A, dealing with that. So instead of using the word Osama, I decided to just use the letter O. And I had read an article in the New York Times. The date is right here. New York Times, December 16, 2001. Where I'm actually shocked that the journalist had this information. I don't know how they got this information, but the article was called "The New York Dreams of Holy War Over a Quiet Evening," and it described a meeting where Osama was with his friends and conspirators, and they were describing. I mean, they were talking about their dreams and reciting poetry and just kind of like having a literary salon to a degree. And apparently in the article, they mentioned that they really believed their dreams were ominous. And they play soccer, and someone had been dreaming about the team, and the team might have been losing in the dream. So when they talked about this, they were really concerned because, of course, they were already perpetrating the crime, and they were concerned that maybe it would mean that the plan would fail. They also, I'm trying to remember what else was in the article, but in any case, I mean, what was really disturbing to me was the fact that they were presented, it's obviously not the journalist's fault, but it was humanizing these people that we've turned into monsters. And
And they turn themselves into monsters.
And they've turned
too.
Themselves into monsters, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. But just the shock, right? The banality of evil.
Right, that's
what came to me. The banality of evil. I mean, here they are talking about their dreams and being really careful. Oh, that's the thing. They were really careful. They didn't want other people to hear about the dreams because they could interpret the dreams and maybe find out about their plans. So it was very secretive. And I think I'm still processing it all. I lived
in
New York.
Were
I was there
on 9/11.
I was there on 9/11.
What was
I was
like?
In Manhattan, and I was in therapy, believe it or not.
Hmm. You were with
and
your therapist.
I was with my therapist
when
and,
the planes hit.
Yeah, and
how did you process that?
I don't know. I'm still in therapy.
So a lot of people are in therapy.
Yes.
So when you got out of that, you got out of the therapist. Just take me out of the therapist room for a second, or was
so
your therapy session
interrupted? We didn't know that it was happening. Hmm. We had no idea. But it was on 14th Street. So, right, I mean, very, very close. 14th and 5th Avenue. Not that close, but still. I mean, we could hear ambulances.
Up.
We could hear
and so you get
sirens,
up, while,
all kinds of things.
While you were in the session, of course, you can hear ambulances in New York a lot, but
mm-hmm.
you don't.
Well, now in hindsight, it's very clear that something major was happening. But when it was going on, I hadn't seen him in a really long time because it was summer, so he took August off, and I had been away in July or something. And I was really involved with what I was telling him. Again, the banality of things. You know, here I am, like, talking about some minor problem in my life.
But things had piled up all summer, probably.
Yes, 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 yes. They had piled up. And here's, the world is falling down, and I'm concerned. And he's a great therapist, so he was paying attention to me. So we weren't aware of what was going on outside. And then I had to teach at Columbia at 10 in the morning. My class was at 10 and therapy was out. I was out of therapy. No, my class was at 11 and my session was from 9 to 10. So when I came out, I was in a rush to get to Columbia University where I teach and where I'm getting a degree. And I got on a bus, a crosstown bus that would take me closer to the line that I was that I needed to take. And these women were talking and they were describing what had happened. And I overheard them, something I love to do. I love overhearing conversations.
So still, even before you got on the bus, you didn't know what had happened.
I had no idea. And they're talking and I go, what? What is it that you're saying? I thought they were talking about a film or something. And they said, you don't know? And then just, they told me and I just couldn't believe it. And I thought, I need to get to my class. And a lot of people at that time, I think that was, actually, I'm very, it's a very traumatic moment, but I was very happy to have been out on the streets and to find out that way. I'm glad I wasn't watching it on TV. Because by the time the people who watched it on TV were already being told what to think, how to experience it. And the people on the street that didn't know, didn't have all that filter and that.
So it was unmediated for you.
It was completely unmediated. And people were trying to get to their jobs. They didn't know how bad it was. So we're all trying to get on the subway and the trains aren't coming. And then there's lines of people trying to call their offices to say they're going to be late because God forbid that they're late for work. And as people are waiting in line, they're talking to their office with their bosses or whatever, and they're getting pieces of information. So it was like broken telephone. Mm-hmm. Because you could hear, what? So it wasn't an accident? What? That they hit another plane?
And then
the Pentagon,
back to you.
I mean the Capitol, and people were just patching the information. So by the time I left the station, I knew what had happened. And I did see one of the towers fall.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what was that like?
It was just too much for words, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was different out here in the Midwest seeing it on TV than it was in New York. So
That's
the intro to this poem, Soccer Dreams.
I'm sorry. Very long introduction.
No,
I'll read the poem.
No, it's a great poem. And I'm always interested in people's 9/11 experiences.
Mm-hmm. Right. Soccer Dreams. Oh, the dream, oh. What team spirit, oh. What enlightened vision of what constitutes metaphor. Football players, yes. When you say football, you mean soccer, right? Your players wouldn't play that other, sinister game, a type of cancer. Your players don't tackle. They kick balls, oh. They must wear shorts, oh. What other games do you like? Shooting videos? Hardly a sport. Mud wrestling? Oh. Sumo? Guess not. It implies a balance of forces. Kite flying? Card playing? And pure, according to you. I've got a couple of questions, oh. If those who kick balls are called pilots, what would swimmers be? Sleepers. Or maybe bombers, oh. Almost bomberos. Get it? And then what if your players switch sides, repeating, de rose, but wa imros, imros hast. Think about it, oh. It might come up in another of your dream interpretation sessions. How surreal, oh. And they say one of your hands can't move. You let others do the kicking, oh. You must be proud. At night and from a distance, ground zero could be taken for a stadium.
That's Monica De La Torre reading Soccer Dreams out of her book of poetry entitled Talk Shows. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Even in a poem so serious as this, you are playing with language. You're playing with the O's.
Mm-hmm.
Sumo,
right.
For instance.
Right. And O looks like a ball.
Yeah. O is the soccer ball.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an O also. I'm just wondering, is there a risk in playing in a poem so serious?
That's a good question. I don't think so. Because it is about this game that they're... I mean, it kind of brings to the forefront how they were using the soccer game as a metaphor for what they did. So in a way, what this poem does is we use the same procedure. So in that way, it's very mimetic. And I don't think I'm rejoicing in the language, or I don't think that's the spirit of it. It's more that, just trying to represent how they conceived of this. And then one thing I didn't say, but that line I read, de rose, ba, wa, imros, imros hast, which I probably mangled when I pronounced it, that means yesterday is yesterday, Yes, yesterday was yesterday, but today is today. And that's because I was reading that what they were worried about of the spreading of information. They couldn't, there's so much going on and such a history in terms of the different sects and tribes and ethnic groups that you're never quite sure of who you can trust. So in this thing where you're playing soccer, it's not as easy. I mean, what I'm trying to say is it's not as easy as dividing the group in two. There's no the good ones and the bad ones, or you're on our side or you're on the other side. Like, everybody could switch sides, and there's much more in between. And in a way, this ending, like ground zero could be taken for a stadium, I'm also pointing at the way we have turned this into a major spectacle. I think that's what's at stake in the poem.
And well, we're going to have to leave our conversation at that, on that note of disaster, attack as spectacle. My guest today has been Monica De La Torre, her book of poetry, Talk Shows. Monica De La Torre, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you so much. This was great.
It's been a pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.